This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
This is the evening edition. I'm Uma Paganampike Pagan, and you're listening to an ongoing series that's dedicated to the superhero. An in-depth look at how this uniquely American invention has grown over the last century to become a global cultural phenomenon. An attempt at better understanding this incredible modern mythology and how it's come to bear such an influence over our collective cultures. And it's something I call When We Last Left Our Heroes. I grew up reading your stuff, so forgive me if this sounds like every question I've ever wanted to ask Paul Levitt.
Well, I don't know that I can sit for every one, but let's do the top 10 or so.
Episode 14, Paul Levitz. Part 1, Growing Up in Brooklyn. Right off the bat, tell me about your first encounter with the art form. Who bought you your first comic? What was it?
When I was growing up in Brooklyn, the normal thing was for kids to have a carton of comics sitting in their garage or their basement, maybe in their room. So the first comics I saw were the boxes of comics that older kids on the block had. Boys who were 3, 4, 5 years older than I was who had accumulated them.
I grew up reading Paul Levitz's stuff. Legion of Superheroes, The New Teen Titans, DC Comics Presents, some Batman, some Superman, Stalker.
Sure. I'm Paul Levitz. I'm comic book writer. I'm an educator these days. I teach college courses on writing, about comics, about publishing. And in my past life, I ran the business side of DC Comics for several decades, finishing up as president and publisher about 5 years ago.
Paul Levitz is a legend in the business, writer, editor. He was president of DC Comics from 2002 to 2009. He has been with the company for over 35 years. Along with publisher Jeanette Kahn and managing editor Dick Giordano, Paul Levitz was responsible for hiring such writers as Marv Wolfman and Alan Moore, artists such as George Perez, Keith Giffen, and John Byrne. He was a key player in the revitalization of DC's comic book heroes in the 1980s. I caught up with Paul by telephone at his home in New York City. You will have to forgive the occasional sounds of sirens in the background. It is, after all, New York City.
The comics that were popular in America when I was a child were either the Disney comics, which didn't do very much for me for whatever set of reasons, or the DC superhero comics. Marvel was just starting and was barely distributed. So there hadn't been too many Marvel comics in those boxes, so I first fell in love with Superman and Batman, Justice League.
And at which point did you know that this was something you wanted to do with your life?
Gee, I think I was doing it before I knew I would want to do it for my life. When I was 9, I read the letter column of Legion of Superheroes, which was my favorite comic. Sorry for the background noise. It's New York City. And the letter column talked about Jim Shooter, who was age 13, having written the story that was in the issue they were talking about. 13? I'll be 13 someday. You know, that was a believable aspiration. So maybe I can do some of this along the way. I didn't think I would have a career in comics or spend my life in comics. As I got older, started doing fan magazines about the field when I was 14, got to know most of the people in the business. They weren't very optimistic about the business. American comics field in the early 70s thought it was going to be dead in a decade or so and was on a path that would have been. I figured I'd get a real job, would go to college with that aim, but I had the opportunity to start working my way through college, doing a couple of days worth of work at DC, So I started doing that, figured, okay, this is cool. I'll get my taste of comics and then I can do real work. Turned out comics started to get to be a little healthier business. And I said, the heck with it. Let me give it a try. Dropped out and went to work full time at it.
And how did you get started at DC? I mean, did you have a mentor who brought you in?
Well, I was doing the fanzine, so I knew pretty much everybody, certainly on the creative side of the company. Was walking past Joe Orlando's office one afternoon after school, gathering information for my little fanzine.
That's the Joe Orlando, associate publisher of Mad Magazine and the vice president of DC Comics. He's worked on everything from Superman to Weird Science to Daredevil.
He said, hey, come in here. Joe never remembered anyone's name. I'm sure he didn't remember mine at that moment. He said, I need somebody to write my letter columns. Will you do that? I said, I'm not a writer, Joe. He said, I read your fanzine. You write well enough to write a letter column. So at 16, I was suddenly a freelance writer for DC Comics. And Joe was certainly my first great mentor in the field. The following summer, his assistant editor was going to take the summer off on vacation. He asked me if I would fill in. I was thrilled to. His assistant never came back and I never left.
So at the time, I mean, you're 16 years old now. You're writing a letter column and I guess you're growing up surrounded by all of these people, all of these, I guess it was Silver Age coming on Bronze Age, writers and artists. And that must have been something. I mean, you must have been surrounded by some of comic book's greatest influences.
Howie Chaykin, who's a couple of years older than I am, but came in at about the same time, likes to joke that we came in at the end of the beginning. We really got to meet the vast majority of people who created the great characters and who really created the business. It was cool at the time. I didn't really understand how cool it was because I was a kid and I didn't have a great historical perspective. But looking back on it, it's totally amazing. I was talking with one of my friends at San Diego Con last year about our growing up experience in the field. And I started to count on my fingers and realized that when I was a kid hanging around DC and learning from all these people, there were 9 people who would end up in the Will Eisner Hall of Fame for comics, running around an office of 30 people. The concentration of talent was just astounding.
The first thing I ever read by Paul Levitz was a comic book called Tales of Ghost Castle. It was the very first issue and featured what I remember to be incredibly creepy stories. One about an adopted girl who murders her new brother and sister and buries them in her garden, and another that featured a twisted dentist and a deal with a demon. Part 2. You were there when they killed Superman. So, Paul, you've been with DC now for more than 35 years. You were its president and publisher for about 8 years, which gives you this pretty unique perspective on the industry. Did you ever imagine the comic book superhero would be as mainstream as it is today?
No. I did not imagine geek culture would win this way.
I'm speaking today to Paul Levitz. He's a writer and editor. He was also the president of DC Comics from 2002 to 2009.
When I went to my first comic convention here in New York in 71, we had 3,500 people there. It was the largest comic convention that had ever been held, and nobody thought we could have a larger one.
2015, there's never been a better time to be a geek. I mean, SDCC is insane. It's being followed by the New York Times, let alone comic book fanzines.
It's being followed by Wall Street. I mean, I have... Obviously, I have some Time Warner stock from my executive days, so I follow media alerts on the stock, and one of the stock analysts announced Time Warner Strong coming off Comic-Con. What the hell?
Fantastic. So what is your take on the industry at the moment? Are we living in the new golden age? Because that's what everyone seems to think, for both fans and creators.
I think for American comics, we're living in an unequaled golden age of creativity. The diversity of what's being published today, current material, the availability of historically great comics, international material, is far beyond what we've ever had in this country, which is truly wonderful. Where there was a line that a writer named Adam Gropnik wrote in The New Yorker a handful of years ago, writing about, in an article about Philip Roth, not about comics, but about writing in general. He said, we're in a golden age of writers, but not a golden age for writers. And I think that's true for the comics world as well. It's a golden age of reading comics. It's not quite a golden age for creating them. Some people are making far more money than they ever have and having wonderful creative freedom. There's an awful lot of people who are still having a very challenging time eating while they're doing their comics.
And why do you suppose that is?
The good news is it's very easy to get things published today between ebooks and self-publishing, changes in printing technology that allow very short print runs. It's very hard to make enough money to pay for the time and the labor that you put into doing a comic if you're only going to sell a couple of thousand copies, much less if you're only going to sell a couple of hundred copies. You know, the economics of the field is really designed in all of publishing for mass distribution and mass marketing. If you can't sell significant numbers of your writing, of your comics, your creativity, whatever it is, you have to do it as a hobby. And comics is a very time-consuming and draining hobby.
In 1992, DC Comics did the unthinkable. They killed Superman. In what was a glorious moment of serialized storytelling, it was this epic saga of life, death, and rebirth. And it would forever change the way comic books would handle their superheroes. Nothing was sacred. Not anymore.
Well, Death of Superman's before I was president. Jeanette Kahn was president and editor-in-chief in those days. I was executive vice president and publisher. We were very much running the company together. Jeanette certainly was the one who was most directly involved in the creative decision on Death of Superman, because Superman was a title she really watched very closely. She was at the creative retreat where Mike Carlin and the writers and artists pitched the idea of killing him, and she was intimately involved in the creative process of that. I was intimately involved in the marketing process and the decisions that if we were going to kill him and have it taken seriously, we would need to suspend the title for several months so we weren't soliciting his rebirth before people read the story of his death. And that really was a major factor in that being taken seriously by the general public. The whole thing was enormously bizarre because it was one of the first moments, maybe the first moment, when the mass audience just sort of stopped and looked at what was going on in comics and treated it as something important.
It made the news all the way out here in Kuala Lumpur as well.
I still don't understand how in the world anyone in Kuala Lumpur is reading and caring about stuff we're doing here in New York. I understand it intellectually, emotionally. It's still kind of baffling to this kid from Brooklyn.
And you know what else that's great about that saga is I think these days everyone and their uncle are killing off characters left, right, and center. But of course, when you guys killed Superman, it wasn't just a gimmick. You'd built this beautiful story around it. And I think that's something a lot of people forget when they talk about the death of Superman today.
I think Mike and the team did an amazing job. The weekly dynamic of what they were doing is so perfect for the comic shops for serial storytelling and so hard to achieve. There have been any number of weeklies done in the last batch of years. And some of them have worked fairly well. But I think that may be the high point of serial storytelling that we achieved in comics.
Part 3, The Art of Modern Myth-Making. So 2 years ago, you wrote this absolute beast of a book, 75 Years of DC Comics, Art of Modern Myth-Making, 720 pages, it's like 16 pounds. And this myth-making, this idea of shaping and directing youth culture, it goes beyond just an American endeavor these days. It's more of a global one. I mean, you're touching people all over the world.
American culture has been the most exportable culture, I guess I'd argue, of the last 40 or 50 years.
That again is Paul Levitz. He is a comic book writer, editor, and educator. He was the president and publisher of DC Comics for 8 years. He is currently writing this magnificent reimagining of Dr. Fate with Sunny Liu.
Japanese manga has caught up, and anime a little bit in the last decade or two. The Brits were doing okay with their film industry for a while, and music is kind of a very separate industry where certainly the British did phenomenally at exporting their culture for a very long time in that, and Scandinavians have done some interesting work. But if you kind of measure by the ton, American culture has by far been the most exportable. We'll see how much longer that continues, but that's really the true American empire, I think.
In recent years, has it actually affected, has global culture affected your process in writing and creating comics? I mean, we see it with the diversity of cultures now in superhero comics. We see a Muslim Ms. Marvel, your new Dr. Fate as well, is more of a global character in many ways.
Well, there's two things at play there, I think. Maybe three. One, Americans have historically been a very parochial society, not particularly interested in what was going on beyond the moats that we perceived surrounding our country. That's shifted in many ways in the last 15 years, partly off the events of 9/11, but partly off the interconnections of the world. Second, specifically for comics, we always had a reader or two in Kuala Lumpur, but we weren't in touch with them. We didn't really have a great deal of consciousness that they existed, and we had no real contact with creative people in other parts of the world. The internet has changed all of that and made those connections accessible and comfortable. And that's brought a whole new raft of wonderful creative people into the field. So, for instance, on Dr. Fate, I have the joy of working with Sunny Liu, who's your neighbor in Singapore, Malaysian born. Sunny did a little bit of work for DC about a decade ago, but 20 years ago, he couldn't possibly have worked for the company. And even a decade ago, it was very difficult. Now the pages come in digitally. I got 4 inked pages from Sunny this morning. It's as instantaneous getting pages from Singapore as it is getting it from next door. Might be easier than getting it from next door in some ways. So the diversity of talent opens things up. The third really interesting thing, and this really bears on what I'm doing, I think, in Dr. Fate, American comics in their first decades, for a variety of reasons, couldn't address ethnicity, religion, sexuality, most things that race, most things that make life complicated for human beings. That's begun to change in the last decade or more at a fairly accelerated pace. So when I had the opportunity to do a new Dr. Fate series, part of the underpinnings was to say, well, the mythology of this character is fundamentally Egyptian. How do I do more of that? How do I address more of that? How do I bring Egyptian mythology into it? Can I bring a kid into it who is Egyptian American? What does that mean? What does that complicate in his life? What are the dilemmas that brings to us? And how do I get story material out of it? And that's so much fun. That's so much richer than what we were able to do decades ago.
And you've taken, I mean, at least for my generation of kids growing up through the 80s and primarily coming of age in the 90s, Dr. Fate was always a secondary character. A lot of us came to him through the DC animated stuff. And I've read issue one. I haven't got my hands on issue two yet. And it's brilliant. I mean, it brings Dr. Fate into a whole new audience. It makes Dr. Fate an A-lister.
Thank you. I hope so. I think mostly what it makes him is an individual. You know, when you think back to whether it's the animated series or Dr. Fate in the Justice Society, whether it was in my stories or any of the other writers, going back to Gardner Fox, who was his original creator, a lot of what kept him from being an A-lister was he wasn't individual. Most of what was true about Dr. Fate was either true about other superheroes or was true about other, at least magical, superheroes. I hope that what I'm doing is I'm giving him an individual world to exist in where he has singular importance and singular characteristics. Forward to going to DC movies for the first time in my life that I don't know the plot of. You know, it's literally going to be the first time I've had that pleasure. Just looking at all the stuff along the way. I mean, I've got 30 years of Marvel comics on my shelf, as well as probably 35,000 DC comics, some frightening number like that. It's all stuff that I loved and care about, and it's great to see it brought to life, and it's on some level, great to see it being a can you top this contest between the two companies.
Part 4. That second half of your life. We're in 2015 and comics are so greatly influenced by these other media threads, television, film, the digital form, all of this. And it must be completely different from when, you know, your biggest worry was getting books on shelves and getting them out the comic store door.
Well, that's the good news, bad news joke about the geeks winning, isn't it?
Paul Levitz is a comic book writer and editor. He was president and publisher of DC Comics from 2002 to 2009.
You know, the good news is the things that we love now pervade all the media. The bad news is we now have to share them with everybody. And the bad news is that we don't have our little world to ourselves with our safe little walls around it. Overall, I'd rather the whole world enjoy our material and share it. It has its challenges.
What direction do you think the industry is going in that sense? I mean, I think both DC, Marvel, Valiant, Image have done well to embrace new technologies and new forms better than most other popular culture industries, better than the music industry for sure, better even than the movie and television industry when it comes to the digital forms.
Well, comics had more to win, you know, compared to movies, television, or music. Those were enormous industries with total penetration of the mass market. Comics, by the 1980s, 1990s, were appealing to a fairly small segment of the population. So all these new technologies open the door to our reaching out to more people, doing more kinds of stories. So hopefully we've done some good work in it. I don't think that work is nearly done. What's wonderful that's going on in American comics is the range of the material being created. And I love superheroes. That's my favorite flavor. You know, I probably will go to my grave with that being my favorite flavor. But you look and you see Raina Telemager come out with books like Smile and Drama and Sisters and start reaching probably a million young girls who had almost no comics being created for them or none that they chose to read. And Raina's stuff somehow broke that barrier and said, hey, kids, come on in. Try some comics. You'll love it. I don't know what they're going to read next after that, but I know they're going to read something next, and I know they're going to create next things after that. And that's a fabulous thing that's going on, and we're seeing that in a number of different directions, and I think we're still at the beginning of that process here in America.
The series has been primarily about superheroes, their influence in our collective cultures, as well as their evolution over the years, because they have changed so much over the years. The Batman and Superman of the 1940s looking nothing like their incarnations today. And I just wanted to ask you this core question, I guess, on superheroes, which is how difficult is it to keep them true to these guiding principles, no matter how much they change with every generation? Because every fan base in every era almost determines what their superhero should be.
Well, the core principles, I think, stay the same. I got in this discussion some years ago with a group of Arab editorial cartoonists who were visiting DC Comics and Mad Magazine as part of a tour in the U.S. And they said, so superheroes, are they just about the American idea that might makes right? And I said, well, I can see where you would see that in them. But I don't think that's what they're about. I think they're about the American idea that we all have gifts, and it's what you do with your gifts that determines who you are in life and what you do. I think the superhero is fundamentally about what it's like to be a gifted person and what you choose to do with those gifts. And will Bill Gates be remembered more for the first half of his career when he made billions of dollars? And he was brilliant, and he saw a little bit of the future of our having a computer on every desk and in every home. Or will he be remembered more for the second half of his career, where he took, I think the article I was reading the other day said he's so far given away $47 billion, and he's eradicated or nearly eradicated a couple of diseases, and he's saved through his foundation with others and many, many others, you know, hundreds of thousands of lives, changed child mortality in countries. I think being a superhero is about that second half of your life. It's about how you change the world. And yeah, it's hard keeping up with the future. It's changing really fast. I think it's harder to write science fiction today, fantasy, than it ever was. But the fundamental challenge of being a hero is still being a hero, standing up and using what you can do to make the world a better place.
When we last left our heroes, the evening edition, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, The Business Station.